podcasts.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
A very good afternoon to you and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, your host for today. This is the show where we interview interesting Christians from around the world about their life, their faith and their testimony. And I'm pleased to say we have not one but two interviews coming up for you this afternoon right here on Premier Christian Radio and also on The Profile podcast available around the world. First up, Premier's Simon Tuck has been speaking to the multi-award winning Nashville-based country music star Josh Turner. Josh Turner is signed to MCA Nashville Records and has released a number of albums, including Long Black Train, Your Man, and Everything Is Fine. His seventh studio album is entitled I Serve a Saviour and was released this past October. Without any further ado, let's listen in to Simon Tuck in conversation with Josh Turner.
Lovely to have you here. Talking about not only your album, but a little bit of history there as well. Country music always part of what the family's been about?
Yeah, in certain ways, yeah. You know, my daddy's mama, I called her Granny. She had a huge record collection in her house full of Southern gospel and country and bluegrass and, you know, just really rootsy Americana type stuff. And so that really kind of laid the musical foundation for me outside of church. And the only album I remember my daddy having when I was young was like a Hank Williams Greatest Hits vinyl record, and I just remember, you know, loving that record. I still have it, and so yeah, you know, I grew up in a tobacco farming community in South Carolina. You know, I just grew up in that rural lifestyle, and so the country music that I was hearing on the radio really kind of served as a soundtrack for my life. And then as I started getting older, I started digging into the older country music, and the only real way I could find that music was to go to antique stores and rummage through old vinyl records. And so that was when I discovered artists like, you know, Loretta Lynn and Johnny Cash and Waylon Jennings and Roger Miller, and, you know, the list goes on and on, Ernest Tubb. And so I just, that really, kind of sparked a passion in me. And Randy Travis was, you know, he had just come on the scene when, you know, I was young, and I just, I don't know, he just looked like, it looked and sounded like a guy who could be living next door to me. And so he really made a difference in me, really had an influence, and really kind of inspired me to pursue this as a career. And so I've gotten to know Randy well over the years. Not only is he my hero, but he's become a friend of mine. And so I've learned a lot from him and John Anderson, and just, you know, a lot of my heroes.
So, family musical in the sense of playing instruments?
Not really. The only instruments really were just kind of church oriented. You know, my grandmama played the piano. My mama kind of dabbled in piano and guitar, but I've never seen her play a guitar. But what's interesting is that when I started to become passionate about singing country music, my granddaddy was at my house one day. And he said, Josh, you know, all these songs you've been singing, he said, it'd be good if you were, you know, learned how to play guitar, you know, while you're up there singing. And I'm like, I'm never going to learn how to play guitar. And so he got up off the couch. He went to the back of my house, and I had no idea what he was doing, but he went in my mama's closet where she had her old guitar, which I don't even think I even knew it was in there, and didn't have any strings on it or anything. And I see him walking out of the house with the guitar in his hand. He never said bye. He never said never said a word to me. Well, then he comes back the next day. He had taken the guitar to town and gotten strings put on it. He had gotten a case for it, you know, and he had gotten like a little Mel Bay guitar instruction booklet, and gave it to me. And he said, "Here, you know, learn how to play it." and that's how I learned how to play guitar.
Wow.
And so, but no, none of my friends played any instruments. The first time I really played with the band was after I got a record deal.
I love your song. Is it called White Noise? Where you talk about everyone else has got their rap music, but I've got my I've got my country.
Yeah. It was a fun song duet with John Anderson, and I don't know. I'd gotten that idea one day. I was listening to like a live Ernest Tubb record from 1965, and I don't know why that inspired that title, but I had always heard the term white noise, and I had always thought about how people always called country music the white man's blues, and so that was really kind of the inspiration behind it. And so John Anderson and I sat down and wrote that song, in a very short amount of time, and he came in and sang it, as a duet with me on it, and it's just a really fun song.
Who has been the person you would most like to still duet with?
Ooh, I've sung with a lot of my heroes. I'd love to do something with, Lyle Lovett one day. I'm just trying to think. I've done, a lot of stuff. And sadly, some of the guys and girls are, passed on. But, somebody like Willie Nelson, maybe, while he's still around. I don't know. It's just there's a few out there.
We're living in the day of holograms. You could actually have a hologram of your favorite artist doing a duet with.
Yeah, that's very true. I don't know if I have the budget for that.
But oh, no, that's great. Where does faith lie with the music? Was it an early age? I mean, you sound like you went to church anyway at a very early age anyway. But there must have been a moment, surely, or was it a gradual change?
I grew up in church. But I don't attribute that as being the sole reason for, why I believe what I believe. As a Christian, my faith comes from my personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And, whether I'm in a church or not, that governs how I live my life personally and professionally. And I can't separate the two. I don't feel like I should, because as long as I have Jesus within me, people are going to see that and hear that within me. And so, I've always loved country music, and I love, a lot of things about country music. I've appreciated the drinking songs and the cheating songs and all that kind of stuff. But when I got my record deal and I started making my own records, I just felt really convicted about, being really careful about the words that I sing, because people listen and they take it to heart and it influences them. And so I wanted to be just real conscious about what I sing and how I sing it. And so that's always been at the forefront of my mind. I love telling the stories, and I've always said too that, one of the main things I love about country music is it allows me to sing about anything I want to sing about.
Yeah.
But even still, for me anyway, I feel like there's a standard, that I work by and I live by. And that comes from my faith.
Yeah. And storytelling is very much what country music is about, isn't it? It's that beginning and end and that middle, and just enabling people to go on a journey with you, whether it's against that cheating woman or it's about this or that or whatever. So
yeah, and there was a trend there for a while in country music where they would always, a lot of records would have, a gospel song at the end. It would be the last track on the record, and I always felt like that was just kind of cheesy, and it was weird. And I've had some faith-based songs on my record, but I wanted to incorporate them as part of the record. I didn't want it to just be an add-on, I felt like if anything, it should, have credibility and have its own, weight. And so, like I say, when I ended up cutting this record, same thing. I wanted each and every song to really have some depth and some meat to it. So So yeah, it's something I've always taken seriously, you know, whether I'm making a country record or not.
For the uninitiated of us, the difference between country and Southern gospel sounds like it's practically the same thing, isn't it?
Somewhat. Southern gospel kind of has a certain sound to it. It's like, for lack of a better term, I'm trying to think of how I could describe this. I guess it's like energetic church music for country people, and that's pretty much what it is. And you've got a lot of you know, harmonies going on. There's a lot of quartets. My granny, she had a lot of records of Southern gospel quartets and stuff like that. So there was always that element of people singing together. Which is, you know, that's how the Gaithers have become so successful, is because they have people singing together. It's always the collaboration, the community aspect of it. So that, and just, you know, the lyrics and the style of the songs, I think, really kind of makes Southern gospel what it is.
You talked about the Gaithers there. Did you approach them? Did they approach you when you've worked together?
That was something that actually they had been kind of talking with my label about, you know, doing a project. And then when they started talking about what kind of project they wanted to do, they had mentioned me, and they knew my reputation, and they got really excited about that. And so they came on board, and I was so thrilled that they did, because, like I say, they've just been a pleasure to work with.
Have they influenced what you've done now since working with them?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like I say, just meeting Bill Gaither, it's just, you can see how he runs his business, and he's very serious minded about what he does too. And he's had a lot of success doing what he's doing. And he realizes that he's not just in the music business, he's in the people business. And so you can tell that just, you know, from the first time you ever speak to him, or even just watching him on TV or listening to him on a record. He's just got that really down-to-earth, approachable kind of personality. And so, you know, yeah, it's definitely something I can learn from.
Now, you obviously love recording albums, because this is your sixth album, I Serve a Savior.
Seventh.
Oh, my apologies.
Yeah.
My apologies.
Yeah.
So,
ninth, if you include my two live records.
Oh, yes. Live better than the recorded?
Not in my opinion.
Do you prefer playing out live, though? Because then you get to see the reaction of the people who bought your record.
Yeah, you know, I can't really compare the two, honestly. You know, when I go out and play live, I realize that it's going to be imperfect, because there's never going to be a perfect live performance, ever. And so, but the imperfect nature of it, I think, is the beauty of it. You know, people can really kind of get a picture of, you know, who you are and what you're about and how talented you are. But for me, you know, when I go into studio, it's all about refinement. I want to make the song as good as it possibly can be. You know, I want to get the best musicians. I want to have the best producer, you know, the best studio, et cetera, et cetera. And I want to sing it, you know, as good as I possibly can. And so I just, you can get in there and you can really just kind of work on making the song really what it's supposed to be. And you can't always do that live. You don't have the means or the ability to do that always live.
We'll go back to the concerts in just a moment, live, but how much, you obviously sound like you're an amazing perfectionist. Does somebody have to go, Josh, could you just now walk away? It's okay. It's good. It's brilliant. Or are you that person that says, no, I'm just going to keep on?
I'm not that kind of perfectionist. It's weird, because I am a perfectionist, but like, I know when to stop. Okay. And I always have. But I know people who don't know when to stop. I wrote with Mac Davis, you know, one time, and you know, he's written several Elvis songs, including In the Ghetto. And he told me when we were writing together, he said, I still don't feel like In the Ghetto is finished. He said, I still want to make some changes to it. So I'm not that level of perfectionist. I want to get in there and I want to get it right. And, you know, I don't want to waste my time doing it. And so when I get it right, I can walk away. And, you know, so yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of a quick learner on things. So it's, and I get bored easily too. So I don't want to spend, you know, every waking minute just working and working and working and changing things. So
is there a song you go back there and revisit from your last 7 or 9 albums?
No. I mean, the only thing that kind of bugs me is that, you know, hearing me sing from all those years ago, yeah, when I was young and when my voice was still kind of maturing, you know, I feel like my voice is better now than it was back then. So there's some things vocally that I would probably go back and re-sing, you know, but it's funny, but the fans love the original versions of these songs. Yeah. It doesn't matter, you know, how old I was when I did it.
So let's talk live and then we'll talk about Long Black Train. Okay. So the song that the fans love the most when you play it live, is it Long Black Train?
You can't compare some of these songs.
Okay.
Long Black Train, definitely. Why Don't We Just Dance is always a fun one. Your Man, just because of how, you know, successful it's been. Your Man kind of, it was my first number one hit, and it was a popular song, but then when it started being sung on just about every TV talent show, that was when it really took off, because we actually, back when I took video and production, that kind of production out on the road, we actually did an intro for that song, and we just did like this video montage, this, you know, just clip after clip of, you know, these people doing that song on these, you know, talent shows. And it was crazy because we couldn't even include them all. I mean, because there were so many. I mean, there was even one from The Voice in Mongolia, and which I didn't even know Mongolia had a version of The Voice. But yeah, I mean, I think there was one from Portugal too, and you know, American Idol, and, you know, I mean, just one thing after the other. Just, I don't know why they gravitate towards doing that song, but that's just the one they pick.
It's so very honoring, though.
It is.
To you, because yeah, they're saying, we like you, we like your song, we want to cover it, and that seems to be there. Is there a song when you play live that it just is so overwhelming when the crowd sing back?
Yeah. Like I say, you know, those three especially, you know, I think, you know, have the biggest impact.
Which is brilliant. Let's talk about the album then. You've revisited Long Black Train again for as a live version of it. Mm-hmm. Why did you do that?
Well, I've kind of touched on it already. You know, I didn't feel like, you know, putting the original on this record made any sense, because my voice has matured and changed, you know, since the original, because it's been so many years. So I just felt like the song deserved a new treatment. And obviously it's never gonna, you know, equal the original, but I felt like it was a great version, especially for a live version. You know, so I just felt like it'd be kind of cool to just put a new, fresh version on there.
You've written 4 of the tracks off this particular album. Which one of those would you say that was the most challenging to write?
I don't know if any of them were really challenging. You know, coming up with the arrangement for I Saw the Light was a little bit of a challenge. But then when I finally figured it out, you know, it was pretty easy. It came to me literally within about 5 minutes. And then the one that I wrote from the ground up was I Serve a Savior, the title track. I wrote that with a buddy of mine, Mark Narmore. And he and I have written tons of songs together. And when he and I get together, it's always a pretty easy process, because we really understand each other. And there's no guesswork involved. It just we get in there and we really kind of get down to the heart of the song. And we don't quit until it's right. And the ironic thing about I Serve a Savior is I actually, that was the last song that I wrote in preparation for my Deep South record. So it wasn't even written, you know, with a gospel record in mind. So when the gospel record came about, I started looking at songs that I had written, and that was the first song that I came across. And when I heard it, I'm like, this is perfect for this gospel record. And so, you know, we cut it, and then it ended up being the title track. So
there must have been a load of songs that didn't make it to the album. Is there some stuff on the back burner for another one?
Yeah, there's plenty to choose from. You know, so it which is a good problem to have, but yeah, there was quite a few that you know, we had considered that didn't make it. Just As I Am is one of those songs. But yeah, you know, and I'm sure I'll end up writing some more too. So
you brought a freshness to a number of familiar hymns. At How Great Thou Art, Great Is Your Faithfulness, and Amazing Grace. What other hymn are you inspired by? Do you say Just As I Am just then?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, would that be another one of those that you want to bring a freshness to?
Yeah, I think so. You know, so if it comes to that, you know, I'm going to try to live with it and spend some time with it and really kind of dig into whatever song it is to really try to make it mine. That's another thing that I've really learned from my heroes, and I haven't always been good at that throughout my career, but I feel like the more experience that I have and the older I get and the more things I learn, the more I figure out how to make songs mine. And you know, because I've always been somewhat of a mockingbird, because the way I learned to sing was really copying, you know, my heroes. I would try to sound exactly like them. You know, I'd try to sound like Ronnie Dunn. I'd try to sound like Clint Black. I'd try to sing like Randy Travis and John Anderson. And so that mimicry was how I learned how to get as good as I am now, because I didn't just try to sing one way. I was always trying to, you know, sing like other people. And then, you know, when I started writing my own songs, I didn't have another artist to base it on. It had to come from me solely. And so that was when I really kind of discovered my own sound. And so I've just been trying to, you know, just hone that, you know, ever since. So
you brought some family on board to sing with you on this particular album. Have they sung with you before?
Not on a record. Well, I take that back. But yes, they have. It was actually on my Punching Bag record. There was a song called Find Me a Baby that my wife and my three oldest boys sang on. They did the little na-na part on that, which was cool. But so, yeah, I guess this technically would be their second time doing this. But it also includes our fourth son. You know, because he wasn't born back then during the Punching Bag record. But yeah, they, you know, probably one of my favorite moments from my career is seeing them perform this on the DVD, on the live performance. It's just, I'm so glad that I didn't get up there with them. I just wanted them to do it on their own. Jennifer's playing piano and singing with them. And just seeing the four of them standing there singing together is just, like, as a father, it's just, you know, it's a pretty proud moment.
Because what your granddad did to you, mm-hmm. you've done for your children, which missed your sort of mum's era there, even though she'd tried it there. So it must be amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. You know, and like I say, my mama never really, you know, continued her piano playing or her guitar playing. And she sang a lot in church. She was in the choir. She sang a lot of solos. One of the songs that she sang seemed like all the time was a song called The Master's Hand. And so we even had like a picture of, you know, like the sheet music and the, you know, stuff like that, you know, from The Master's Hand on the wall in our house. So it was always like, you know, I couldn't escape that song. I don't know if she ever thought about singing for a living or if she did, I never knew about it. But yeah, she and my daddy both, they really kind of pushed me once they realized that I had a talent to sing and had a passion for it. The ironic thing is I didn't want to go out and sing in front of people. I was terrified of that, but they pushed me to go out and sing at beauty pageants and ball games and private parties and, you know, anywhere that somebody needed entertainment, they were pushing me to get out there in front of them. And then she, during my junior year of high school, she actually pushed me to go and audition for a country show in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And it was it's the oldest show in Myrtle Beach. It's an open air amphitheater right on the beach, and it's called High Steppin' Country. And so they would sing and dance and do all different styles of music. The first half of the show was all country music, and then the back half was, you know, gospel and like 50s rock and roll and, you know, Broadway, you know, show tunes kind of thing. And so it was a pretty eclectic show, but that was the show that really kind of taught me how to perform, because we'd do three shows a week and every crowd would be different. You'd have some that would just kind of sit there and, you know, stare a hole through you, and then there'd be other ones, they'd be up dancing in the aisle, you know. So it just kind of helped me, you know, kind of adapt to each and every crowd.
You're listening to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, your host for today's show. We've got not one, but two interviews for you today. You were just hearing Simon Tuck in conversation with Josh Turner, but stick around, we've got another great interview coming up for you right after this.
Join me, Justin Briley, for a new season of The Big Conversation with world-class thinkers, including Sir Roger Penrose and William Lane Craig on God and the Universe, Bart Ehrman and Peter J. Williams on Jesus and the Gospels. Join the conversation as we explore life's biggest questions at thebigconversation.show.
Do you want to stay informed on the best of what's happening in the UK church today? Premier Christianity Magazine is for you. The UK's leading Christian magazine is published every month and features interviews with Christian leaders, in-depth reporting, reviews, columnists, and loads more. And best of all, you can try it for free. Head to our website now to request the latest edition worth £5.95, completely free of charge.
Visit premierchristianity.com/free sample.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, your host for today's show. You were just hearing Simon Tuck in conversation with the country music star Josh Turner. But now, something a little bit different for you. We've dug back into the archives for the second part of today's show. This first aired on Premier Christian Radio a number of years ago, but it's never aired on The Profile podcast before. And it's a great conversation between Premier's Maria Rodriguez and Pippa Gumbel, the author of a daily Bible commentary, Bible in a Year, which she puts together with her husband, Nicky Gumbel. Nicky and Pippa Gumbel are, of course, well known for pioneering the Alpha Course and for pastoring Holy Trinity Brompton here in London. So Maria wanted to sit down with Pippa Gumbel and find out more about her life. Let's have a listen in.
Well, Pippa, welcome to the programme. It's great to have you with us today.
It's lovely to be here.
Now, Pippa, I'd like to go back and find out what life was like for you when you were a little girl growing up. Did you go to church? Was church part of your life?
Yes, I did go to church. My parents took me regularly to church, and actually I went to a convent school for some of the years of schooling, and there we had church all the time. And of course, I would have said I was a Christian, but I understood nothing about the Christian faith. It probably gave me some sort of deep foundations, but I didn't understand until I was 18 that you could have a relationship with God. And that was when it changed my life.
So I guess in a sense, these sort of values and a sense of perhaps morality was being instilled in you, but that relationship with God hadn't actually sort of come into being.
Yes.
So what happened when you were 18 then?
I knew Nicky then. He wasn't my husband or a boyfriend, but he was a friend. I knew him well. And he went off to university. And during his second term, there was a mission there. And he became a Christian. I mean, he and quite a lot of his friends. It was a wonderful mission where a lot of them became Christians. And when I next saw him at a party, he was sort of running around with tracts in his pocket, trying to convert everybody. And I thought he'd gone absolutely mad. And I thought I'd actually back off and keep a little bit away from him because I didn't know what he was up to, but it didn't seem normal to me. And then I was working with somebody and she suggested that I went and visited her sister who was working in something called the kitchen. And it was an informal place. They'd converted a garage. It was a place where you could drop in, have homemade bread and soup, and people were gathering. And I didn't realise they were Christians. Oh, I thought they were just nice people getting together. Yes. I was a real sucker. And I sort of went in, thought they were nice. And actually, there was something different about these people. I knew that. The world I was living in was pretty superficial. The relationships were shallow. And actually, I was pretty empty when I started going along there. And I could see in them these people loved me for who I was. There was a different attitude and atmosphere there. And so I just kept going back to this place. And then somebody opened the Bible one day with me and we read John 10:10. Jesus said, I've come to give you life and life with all his fullness. And I thought, yes, that's what I want.
And at that moment, did you have a sense of, well, I need to go to church now? Did you understand what the next step was?
No, I don't think I understood at all, actually. I went back and prayed. I remember I was staying in, I was sharing a flat with some people and we had bunk beds and I knelt down by my bunk bed and I prayed and I knew that I'd experienced Jesus, that he'd come into my life, forgiven my sins and that I'd started this relationship. And I can remember going back to the kitchen the next day and them saying, well, we must buy you a Bible. I thought, why do I need a Bible? I know now. I've got it. Why would I want a Bible? So I had a lot to learn. So they helped me get a Bible. And then they suggest that we all gathered sort of to pray for me. And I think that was probably the most awkward thing that had ever happened to me. I'd never been prayed for aloud and with everyone around me.
Breadcrumbs all over their hands as they were laying hands on you. And
I was dying. I mean, it wasn't the most wonderful spiritual experience. I was just longing for it to be over. But I'm sure it was a very important part of my journey.
A humbling one, if nothing else.
Definitely a humbling one.
And amazing, though, isn't it, how God can move with that situation of being in a garage. Yes. You know, it's kind of, you know, back to kind of this idea of, you know, children's nativities in a stable, this thing, sense of in this sort of simple place, far away from the superficiality of what you've been living, God was able to break through.
And I suppose in a way it was like early stage, not dissimilar from Alfred. It was people gathering to eat food together and to talk about their faith. And that was a safe, easy, relaxed environment. So it was like the pre-runner, the forerunner of Alpha that came along many years later.
Amazing how God was sort of laying the foundations there in that experience for what's to come with Alpha.
Yes.
So at this point, you said you were sort of previously been running away from Nicky. So had you been in contact with him since?
I don't think I had, but I started working, or I was definitely going to this place called The Kitchen regularly. And he came back from university and went along because obviously he heard that this was, you know, fun young place for young Christians to hang out. And my name was the first name in the book.
Oh,
and so then we sort of re-met up.
Yeah. So as things went on, did you realise that maybe he wasn't quite the bizarre person that you thought, strange man throwing these tracks around?
It's so funny because I thought what had happened to me in London was totally different from what had happened to him. But then I began to understand in the context, it started to make sense that he was just passionate about wanting to spread the good news, which is not a bad thing. It's just how you do it that's important.
Yeah. So at this point, obviously, this is all a whole new experience for you. You say you weren't really sure about the need for the Bible and so on. Did you have sort of plans for your future, what you wanted in your life?
No, I don't think I had any plans at all. I had no idea what I would do or where I would go. And I certainly would never have seen myself as a vicar's wife all these years later.
God's sense of humour.
Definitely.
As you entered into a relationship with Nicky, did you realise over time that perhaps this was the life that you were going to have? Or was it, again, something that was a bit of a surprise as things unfolded?
Well, I knew he was passionate about ministry and particularly about wanting to bring people to Christ, for people to understand and have a relationship with Jesus. But he was doing his law exams and his bar finals and then a pupillage. So I was marrying a student lawyer.
Mm.
And so I didn't know what direction we were going. I had no idea which direction we were going. But we were very involved with the church even then. So we'd joined HDB by that stage. We were running a small group in our home. We were involved on Sundays. So in some ways it was a natural progression. And I think, although there are huge pressures about of being a clergy wife and being part of that ministry, Nicky, if he'd stayed at the bar, would have had to work terribly hard, which he did. Mm. And quite often he would come back and we'd have the home group coming for arriving for supper, and he'd have been given a brief just as he'd left, and he'd have to go upstairs and work in the bedroom and say, "I'm so sorry, I can't come, to the barber, so you'll have to just do it." And there were pressures like that. You couldn't rely on going away or having a weekend off. So there were huge pressures if he'd stayed there. So you have different pressures when you're part of the church, but the privilege is that we do it together. Mm. And I think that is such a wonderful opportunity to work together.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, not many married couples get to do that except outside of the context of ministry, and to be able to share that is quite a privilege, as you say. Of course, when your children came along, did the dynamics of it all change, though?
Well, I think then you have to balance how much work in the ministry. Different things kick in at that time, and we were always involved with small groups and Alpha and women's groups and things that were happening in the day around the children. But obviously you have to make sacrifices of what you can be involved in. And I think that's part of growing up as well, realising how blessed you are to have children. The worst would be going on a sort of weekend where there was ministry going on and wishing you were in the meeting and having to look after the children. I worked out it was much better to think, if I get into some of the ministry, that's great. Mm. But otherwise, go and just enjoy the children. If you try and do both, you feel torn. You're never happy wherever you are. You're feeling guilty wherever you are. So actually, just to decide you're going to go and do the children, and that's great. And then anything else is a bonus.
Yeah.
So yes, there's more juggling. And obviously, evenings are complicated as they get older and the demands of the church. You have to balance that. And there were certainly times when the children were getting a little bit older and they were around a lot, when we realised it actually wasn't good to have too many meetings in the house. The children actually needed a bit of quiet. They needed the home to be their own and not just to have endless people pouring in. So I think you have to go on reassessing. We made so many mistakes. If I did it all over again, I would do it completely differently.
Well, that's interesting because, obviously it sounds like you did make some wise choices along the way. For example, realising the children needed a distinction between home and meetings, but you still think there are other things you would have done differently.
I think there are plenty I would have done differently.
So obviously as this journey progresses and you both take on new roles within the context of HDB, more responsibility, the church has really grown, beyond all proportion. It's almost a sort of an organisation really within lots of other organisation networks and so on. Do you think that actually that's because you both had vision or just because God has somehow just allowed this to unfold?
Who knows? God, I think God has been very gracious to us. I think he's also raised up people with passions for all sorts of things. So Nicky and Scylla Lee are passionate about family life. And, they live, breathe, dream family life. And that is who they are. And they are so good at pioneering all that. And it's lovely to be able to see them blossoming in that, all the things that they've written, all the courses, the books, that they work on, and they go on believing in that. And then seeing Paul Cowley being raised up and seeing him, of what he's done. I mean, it is the most extraordinary story. Someone like Paul growing up in an estate with no education, having been in prison himself, now running the second largest prison ministry in the whole world. Sometimes you just have to stand back with your mouth open and think, wow, God, you are amazing. And Paul is a strong character. So he's, driving forth there and so good because he never rests. And Nicky's like that too. He's always for moving forward. He's always for the next church plant or the next whatever it is. And that's part of the character he is. But it's God has been kind and raised up people to enable us. I mean, we couldn't do any of it on our own.
Yeah, and I think that's the good thing that we need to be reminded of, that it is God's work, and it's just us simply offering what we've got and allowing God to do what he will with it. Definitely. Now, some people looking from the outside in, Pippa, might be looking at yourself and looking and thinking, wow, they must have their whole life sorted. Everything must be rosy. I'm sure they've never had any struggles or challenges. What would you say to that?
I think we're just very normal people. Everyone, sadly, has the same... I think most people have the same issues in life. We all get sick. We all get exhausted. We all have issues, misunderstandings, those sort of things that are just normal life. Disappointments, friends going through awful times, all those things. There are things in our lives that are terribly sad, and you have to find your faith in those moments and hold on. But I think we're pretty normal, really.
Yeah. Now, sort of almost living out your faith fairly in the sort of public eye, is that sort of a double-edged sword, both a blessing and a burden at the same time?
I think it's very easy to sort of forget that you are. And I often forget that people know us when... even in the congregation now, it's so difficult to know everybody. It's so big. And wonderful. We've travelled in all sorts of places and done conferences in around America, around Asia, around Africa, everywhere. We've seen the world, and that's such a privilege to see what God is doing everywhere. And there are wonderful people, faithful people all over the world. The church is still alive, and love being part of that. But I meet people who sort of say, "Do you remember me? We met in Ohio." I'm thinking, I don't even remember Ohio, which is just so awful. And I wish I did better. I'm not very good on people's names and faces. So it is very hard to remember everybody and remember where you've been and what you've done. I should catalogue it much better.
Well, that would take a lot of time, wouldn't it, to make a note of all of that? But I think that, I guess, is part of the nature, isn't it, of being involved in some sort of international ministry, that you are going to meet a lot of people, have a lot of encounters. Are there maybe one or two people that stand out on your journeys you've travelled around? And perhaps a difficult question, because there's so many people you would have met, some you remember more, some you remember less. People that stand out and you just think, yes, you're an inspiration to me.
I think many people. When we were last in Zimbabwe and were there and just saw that the church has survived such a difficult time, there were many people. There was a woman who had just started a charity in one of the hospitals, because during, I think it was the very bad times, obviously it's improved a little bit now, but of course the infrastructure is still very bad. There was so few resources for children's wards. So she's just started a little charity, even if there is just bringing toys in and clean clothes for just helping the local hospital, because they had practically no resources there at all. I think she said there was only one kidney machine in the whole of the country.
Wow.
And the whole sort of infrastructure was breaking down of health. And so, and I mean, very sad. So by the time people were coming in, because nobody was picking it up in the countryside, the children often with horrible growths, things that nobody would do, tumours at the side. But she was in the hospital just bringing some love and normality. And I just thought, you're an amazing woman. So she is one that I remember doing an extraordinary thing. But there are so many in Africa, in India. We have two of our children live in India. So they're doing wonderful work out there. It is inspiring that so many people around the world that never ever get thanked or noticed are faithfully looking after children in a slum in Africa or wherever it is.
Mm. Is it a relief to you, mentioned the children there, that they've sort of almost come out the other side into adulthood and they are, you know, serving and doing things for God? Is that a relief that you've kind of got them through that phase now?
I feel very blessed in many ways. Not that you don't go on worrying, of course, we're not allowed to worry.
Yeah. I know what you mean, yes.
Praying yes. For them, because actually the choices they make, the decisions are just are bigger when they're around the world. And having two living in India, there are plenty of things to pray about.
I can imagine.
Of safety, health, yes. All sorts of things, and dealing with quite complicated issues. Our daughter's working for an organisation called Justice and Care, and they are deal with rescuing young women and sometimes children from prostitution and being trafficked in. And that's a pretty full-on job. So I think I definitely pray for her quite a lot. You know, is life easier that she's now out in India doing these terrifying things?
No, probably not.
Or when she was three and yes. going to nursery school? I don't know. It's just different.
Yes. Well, you never stop being a parent, do you?
You never stop being a parent. But I'm so grateful to God that he has brought them through, that we might have done lots of things wrong as parents, which I'm sure we did. And I'm sure they're having to sort out, have counselling for all the things we did wrong. But that they all, you know, are passionate about their faith and they're serving Jesus in whichever ways they can. Mm. And that, for me, is deeply humbling. In fact, they're far more radical and have a far more amazing faith than I do. And I'm just amazed by them.
Now, obviously, all of this, you know, this life of faith is not possible without prayer. And of course, a big part of HTB is prayer, of course, now 24/7 prayer. For you, is that really the key to everything? That if we get prayer right, we understand prayer, then everything else just slots into place?
Prayer is hugely important and something that I need to do more and more of.
I guess we'd all say that, wouldn't we? New Year's resolutions, everybody could say pray more, isn't it?
Yeah. It's pray more and get fit.
Is yeah, well, it's like the two, isn't it?
And praying, you know, it's definitely an enemy who robs us of our time. We love the 24/7 prayer. Pete Gregg is an inspiration. He makes prayer meetings so much fun. I just love being at any prayer meeting that he runs.
Yeah.
And having the 24/7 prayer room open,
of course, yes,
is extraordinary. It does have the most wonderful atmosphere there. And of course, God is everywhere. And I mean, I like to pray and walk sometimes. I find that quite helpful. I get a bit distracted in the house because I can see all the things that need doing.
It's the trouble, isn't it?
But getting out sometimes and just going and walking is lovely. But actually going to the prayer room is amazing. You can just sense the atmosphere. And it's a horrible hut that we have. They've made it as nice as they possibly can. But it is only a Nissen hut that the prayer room is. It has the presence of God there.
Do you find that for you, you're constantly learning from the people you're meeting, the things you're doing? Because, I mean, obviously, although HTB and Anglican heritage, a lot of work through Alpha and so on, done with all different church denominations. So has that been quite a learning process for you?
It's been wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. Love it all. What we have worked with all the denominations across the world, and we've learned so much from the Catholics. We love those. We've had Father Aniero Cantamalesa speaking at our conferences. He's going to come again to the leadership conference, not this year, but next. He couldn't come this year and he wants to come the year after, although he's in his 80s. He has taught us so much. He's written amazing books. His friendship is so humbling. And we had Cardinal Schoenberg at the leadership conference this year. And again, I'm so humbled. A cardinal, a Catholic cardinal, comes to an Anglican conference at the Albert Hall with very loud music and loves it.
Mm.
And he was so godly. He looked like Jesus. We all just sort of looked at him and wanted to be like him. Everyone sort of fell in love with him. And he was sitting next to me and we were listening to the worship, which was quite loud. And I did say to him, are we deafening you? And he said, it's so exciting. And I find it just so
beautiful,
deeply humbling. So we've got the friendships with the Catholics, and then we've got friendships with Hillsong. We've been down to the Hillsong conference. Nikki's spoken there. We're great friends there. I think their music, their worship is wonderful. I love the fact that we can work with all these different people.
Mm.
And many of the churches across England, we get together, we have a group that meet once a year, some of the big churches across England, and some of them are Anglican, most of them aren't, and they're all good friends and we're in it together, and that's fantastic.
I think, certainly from my experience of travelling around, there seems to be a real grace of kind of ecumenism here in the UK, like I've not seen anywhere else. Would you agree with that?
Definitely. I think that's changed probably over the years. It's grown and grown. But even John Wimber, when he came back in all those years, always did a conference with everybody. And I think even Billy Graham before that had Catholics, which was unusual, on his committee for evangelism. So I think it's really worked. I think in some of the other countries, like, I'm no expert, so I couldn't judge, but certainly here, it has changed. The barriers have come down. And I think if you ask most people at HDB, are you an Anglican? They wouldn't have a clue. They would not have a clue.
It's interesting, actually. Yes, a lot of people in different churches, whether they're Pentecostal or whatever, might not necessarily know the history of where their church has come from, yeah. or even what the denomination stands for. And perhaps a sign that maybe there is this sort of greater sense of, well, we're all Christians, just express our worship in slightly different ways. Yeah. So obviously, we've been on this journey with you, Pippa, and we've seen so many different aspects of your life. And I think it's just been a great comfort to people to realise that actually, you know, God can call someone into international ministry, and yet they can be, for want of a better word, kind of just living an ordinary life, you know, that God can take anybody, do incredible things with them. Now, if there's anyone listening this morning and they're thinking, wow, you know, this is amazing what God's done with Pippa, it's amazing what God's done with Nikki, how can I be maybe obedient to what God's calling me to do? What would you say to that?
Well, I think the fact that God has used me... is extraordinary. I love the verse, his power is made perfect in weakness. Because I have great weaknesses. I would never have seen myself as a church leader or a leader of anything. And I, you know, I'm not a church leader, but I don't know really how I've ended up doing what I've done. And I remember the first time Nikki got me to even sort of say hello at something, I nearly died of fright and I sort of shook for hours.
Like Paul, coming in fear and trembling.
Definitely in fear of trembling. So I still find it extraordinary that, and it's taken me a long time, so I think the wonderful thing is you're never too late. You know, not to worry whatever stage of life you're in. And I've seen many of my friends in later stages of their life having new ministries, of suddenly the children have gone and suddenly they are doing wonderful things. I met a woman in her 60s who went on holiday in India. She was grandmother, and I think her, you know, her children had gone or whatever. And she has started a ministry. She's partnered with a pastor out there, and she's partnered with him, and they are rescuing street children. She started doing that. She's a grandmother. She goes around on a scooter, and she sort of takes children out of dustbins and takes them back. And they've started house after house. They've started with one house, or she just took it back to her home to start off with, and now they've started schools and houses, but with this amazing Indian pastor. And she was just a grandmother in her 60s going on holiday and decided she could do something sort of a little bit more radical. So I think God uses the unlikely, and I whatever gifts that you have, and I haven't got any obvious gifts, I haven't got great qualifications in anything, and yet God has been kind enough to put me in a position in a church that is so surprising. So I think wherever you are in life, God can use you, and he can use you even more than you can ever imagine. And occasionally we need to be a little bit braver and step out a little bit more and believe that God can use us even more. And just follow what things that you like doing, and you may find that God will surprise you.
Well, on that note, encouraging note, we'll leave it there. Pippa, thank you so much for joining us and sharing some of your life story and what God's been doing in your life. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales. You were listening to my colleague Maria Rodriguez in conversation with Pippa Gumbel. I do hope you enjoyed that interview. We dug it out of the archives just for you. That's all we got time for on the show today. But don't forget, if you want to hear more great interviews like those, then why not download The Profile as a podcast, absolutely free of charge. And that will give you access to well over 100 different interviews the team here at Premier have done with leading Christians from across the world and from all walks of life. If you want to check that out, just search for The Profile wherever you normally get your podcast from, or go to premierchristianradio.com/The Profile. This show, The Profile, is brought to you in association with Premier Christianity Magazine. That's the UK's leading Christian magazine. It's published every month, features interviews, news, reviews, columnists, and fascinating features on all sorts of different topics, all from a Christian perspective. If you'd like to have a look at the magazine, we're offering you a free copy. Just go to premierchristianity.com/free sample. All you have to do is put your address in, and we will send you a free print copy of the latest edition direct to your front door. premierchristianity.com/free sample. That's our free gift to you today. Do take advantage of that. And we will see you next time.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper. Distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.